Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your top of the week podcast, brought to you by the magazine that's been trying to abolish everything for 56 damn years. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Yeah, it is. Happy, Peter. The second Trump administration has, since last we met, come more into focus over a flurry of proposed cabinet picks. Things started off semi-normal, I guess, if a bit more interventionist than most libertarians would like, in foreign policy, with a selection of Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, Mike Walls for National Security Advisor, Elise Stefanik for UN Ambassador, and so on. Then came the Star Wars cantina picks. You had the ethically challenged Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz for Attorney General, Fox News bro Pete Hegseth for Defense, idiosyncratic Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence, and Robert F. Mother Lovin' Kennedy Jr. for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Meanwhile, a brand spanking new non-cabinet department called DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, I guess, was trolled into being, starring none other than Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, with a rhetorical mandate, at least, to slash the hell out of government. Catherine, let's obviously start there, given your proclivities towards rockets, but also because you literally have an issue on the newsstands right now that says abolish everything. So first question, did you send an autographed copy to the new headquarters of the Department of DOGE out there on the seastead?
Yeah, listen, we are very, very happy to provide ideas to the good gentleman at the DOGE. And we have, that is a sentence I just said also. We do. We have a whole issue that's like, hey, here are a bunch of government departments that probably shouldn't exist and have a long proven record of doing not such great stuff. Ta-da. So here we are at Reason, oddly timely. I said last week on this podcast, my ray of sunlight in the Trump administration is Elon Musk bouncing around trying to get rid of $2 trillion. And I guess this is the form that's going to take. The fact that it is not and really can't be an official, cabinet level position, that it's not a real agency. Like, all of these questions are pressing for those of us who would like to see action from this group. But the fact that it exists at all is charming. I'm not
Nick,
mad.
Meanwhile, you last week were scoffing audibly about Vivek Ramaswamy being serious at all about cutting government. Yet here he is on the weekend chat shows saying, and I think I can quote, we expect entire agencies to be deleted outright. Deleted. That's because he comes from computers.
He's a tech guy, Matt.
Is there some opportunity here? If so, how can we focus their work?
I think there's definitely an opportunity, partly or mostly because of the way that government spending has increased massively over the past several years, especially since 2019. And what I think is the most important thing to do, if we want to ultimately think about government efficiency as the scope of government, it has to have something to do with an overall bottom line number, and that there needs to be a freeze on government spending. I would love to see it at 2019, before COVID hit, before all of that, and just say, hey, you know what, we're going back to that number, and then let people figure it out within that. What I worry about with the Department of Government Efficiency is, because it is not an actual government agency, it has already been kicked into that kind of netherworld territory of the Grace Commission and other government commissions that are appointed, going back to at least Teddy Roosevelt's time, where you have a bunch of outside people saying, hey, you know what, let's get rid of all of this shit that I don't like or that the perceived constituents don't like. So we'll get ready to hear a lot about getting rid of the National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities, all of which, you know, we can absolutely do without. And we should start taking all of the small change off the table. But if we really want to reduce the size, scope, and spending of government, the way you do that is by capping spending first and then start ratcheting it downwards.
And let's remember always that the 2019 levels were way too damned high already. But you got to start somewhere. Peter, I feel like there's going to be a lot of the phrase waste, fraud, and abuse. Waste, fraud, and abuse. You have covered the difficulty. I believed you analogized it to whack-a-mole with waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare system. Can you explain the challenges that they might have, these Dogesters, with going after waste, fraud, and abuse?
So listen, there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse in the government, but those categories are actually kind of porous. It's somewhat difficult at times to tell what is waste and what is actual fraud or abuse. And these are different things. One is just sort of, well, we could be a little bit more efficient. Actual active fraud is a different category of things. That is people scamming the government. That happens a lot with Medicare and Medicaid in Florida in particular, although they have done some crackdowns. There's historically been a huge amount of just active fraud in which medical providers or crank quasi-medical providers, and I'm not talking about RFK here, right? Like they set up these little storefronts and then they bill for stuff that they don't do. This is a whole subplot in the Vince Vaughn Apple TV show Bad Monkey right now, because it's set in Florida and it happens a lot in Florida, and Florida's economy is like a Medicare fraud economy. Rick Scott didn't exactly do that. And in fact, I think he was like, he never went to jail or anything, so he's never convicted. But like there was like, he was involved with a company that was that perpetuated the largest Medicare fraud in history. So it's not just something that you see, you know, sort of in little storefronts in Florida. You also see it in at the top ranks of Florida politics. And this is, I think, it's good, of course, to try and root this stuff out. It's good to have less waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. At the same time, it's just not going to provide you a path towards a balanced budget. It's not going to fix the deep problems with government. And I think that anytime you see somebody say, look, that's the main thing that we're going to target, that tells you that they are probably not really serious about addressing the deep problems with the American government's fiscal picture, which are mostly related to entitlements, to a lesser extent with defense spending. And then all of that comes back to pile on the debt, and which creates interest payments. And right now, the biggest category of waste is interest, but the biggest category of government spending that is growing the fastest is interest on the debt. We are paying right now. There's a huge carrying cost to have all of these debt and deficits. And if you don't ultimately get entitlement spending, that's Social Security and Medicare in particular, under control, if you don't get that under control, then you're not going to be able to control interest on the debt. You're not going to be able to fix America's long-term fiscal issues.
Here's the thing, though. We spent the last several years being sad that Republicans had stopped even paying lip service to doing any kind of fiscal responsibility, any kind of cutting of government. At least we're back to lip service. Like, I'll take this for now. Maybe that's all it ends up being. But I will just want to be clear. Many, many, many of the other things the Trump administration is proposing to do, hate it. Really, really hate it. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that. But the federal government ran on $4.4 trillion 5 years ago. It should not be that hard to cut. Trump's budget, such as it exists right now, is above seven. So I don't know how they're going to reconcile that.
Except that Trump helped jack spending up even before COVID hit, and then he went above and beyond the call.
Absolutely.
To your point, though, Catherine, you know, this is like get rid of the little stuff, and actually the abolish everything issue of Reason, which is on the website now, and I believe it's fully available to people even if they're not subscribers. But
yes,
there are a lot of little cuts that can be made where you can't just say, okay, we're going to get rid of waste, you know, fraud and abuse. For reasons I'll explain in a second, but we can do stuff like privatize as much of the national park system as possible and just get the government out of doing things that may not add up to $2 trillion, but the government shouldn't be doing in the first place, certainly not the federal government. So go after all of those. But then when you start talking about waste, you know, fraud and abuse, Christina Romer, who was Obama's chief economic advisor and I guess treasury secretary for a while, I can't remember now, but she said that almost 30% of Medicare payouts were incorrect and that you could get rid of them without hurting the amount of care. You know, about the same amount of earned income tax credit payments are misdirected. They shouldn't be happening. Fixing that is really hard because the minute you start doing something like that, you hear a lot of bitching and moaning from people, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. The only way to reduce government spending is by putting a cap on overall expenditures and really holding the feet, you know, people's feet to the fire. That's one part of it. But what DOGE could do is start running the table on these smaller things. But I don't think they're going to do that because it's just going to turn into, this is the next issue in the culture war. Because you're going to hear Vivek Ramaswamy, who is nothing but a culture warrior. He's never held office and he's never done anything other than complain about, you know, Woke Incorporated. And Elon Musk, who is getting a ton of government subsidies all over the place. They're going to start saying, oh, you know, what we have to do is we got to get rid of anything that helps, you know, food additives in the, you know, we got to go after fluoridation. They're just going to be using this forum as a way of talking about their own pet idiosyncratic culture war problems. And that
What happened to Captain Cautiously Optimistic from last week, man?
I am.
What happened? What happened to what's going to happen?
We're going to get to that,
Catherine.
Yeah,
I know. You know, I'm extremely
is turning me into a gay frog. No,
I
am cautiously optimistic. I'm not about DOGE because the fact that this is not it's not an actual government department. It means this is the way that Trump gets Elon Musk out of his plane. So that he doesn't have to hang out with them anymore. And he can be like, oh, you know, we're good friends. I'm just not listening to any fucking thing you say. And because Elon has main character syndrome, he won't know the difference.
I do want to note in the abolish everything issue, the one that actually has occasioned, I think, the most ire. Like, we literally were like, abolish the army. We were like, abolish the Fed. And the thing that has made people the most mad is the National Park Service one.
Of course.
People are mad about that.
That's why they threatened to close the national parks first.
Every time.
It's America's
DOGE
greatest
is
idea.
Obviously an opportunity. If you are a limited government person, I think you have to look at DOGE and you have to, on the one hand, say, well, look, the track record of Donald Trump in terms of cutting government spending is very bad. Demonstrably, government spending was much higher when he left office than when he started. On the other hand, you have someone like Elon Musk, who is a smart guy, who has executed in some really difficult industries, not just once, but several times. So just like not a fluke. He didn't just get lucky. And one of the things that he does in his companies is that he finds ways to promote efficiency by just taking stuff out of the process, taking stuff out of the machine. This is sort of his theory of how to build something that works really well is see if it works without it, and only if it really just like collapses without this thing, without this process, without this this part involved, well, then we'll put it back in. And if he can take that approach to government, then that is something that I would love to see. I think you have to be sort of, you can't think, well, this is definitely going to work. You can't go into this thinking this is for sure, you know, just going to be the way that we cut a ton of money out of the federal budget. But you also have to start with and say, look, this is somebody who is trying, someone who is smart, someone who is an outsider and who can come to this with fresh eyes in a way that a lot of people in Washington just are not capable of because they've lived here for forever and they accept that government spending just goes up and up and up and up and there's nothing you can or even should do about it.
There are people, if one is serious about cutting government, deleting entire agencies, making things more efficient, then one should be going straight to the Florida home of Bob Poole, who's been working at Reason now for 5,000 years, doing really important and vital public policy research and agitation on all of these things. Why Bob has been working on this for so long that he wrote the first magazine article about deregulating airlines back when people liked deregulation. There are people, not just Bob, and I'm not saying that he would say yes, but you should knock on his door. There are not just Bob, but there are people at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. There's some people at the Cato Institute. There are people all over in other think tanks that are not explicitly libertarian, but who have been doing serious public policy research and advocacy about this stuff for decades and decades and decades and have been right and have been rigorous. So if you want to do more than just be a flash in the pan, go there. The work is on the record. The ideas are just sitting there and have been tried out in many cases, too, and have succeeded in many cases as well. Go there. That's more interesting than being a Fox News pundit, I swear. All right, let's go to the freak off section of the cabinetry here. Among Trump's aforementioned cabinet suggestions are noted blowhard horn dogs, Matt Gaetz. Ugh. And I mean, where's the lie? Where? Nope. Blowhard?
No lies detected.
Horn dog? Matt Gaetz and RFKJ. One is a target of various criminal and ethics probes. He's to head up the Department of Justice. And the other, a conspiratorial, big government activist to head up the health agency that oversees scientific studies and 20% of federal government spending. These are the two picks that are most likely to be derailed, probably, in the Senate confirmation process, although there is a very strong anti-Tulsi Gabbard contingent as well, who I think are indulging in some conspiracy theories of their own. Maybe we'll get to that later. Catherine, your rocket friend, said the fact that a, quote, staggeringly dumb warmonger, end quote, like John Bolton, was against Matt Gaetz was a great sign. And that, in conclusion, Gaetz will be great. So does the eyebrow warrior have your vote?
There was so much in that question, and I don't know where to start. Yeah. No,
Matt Gaetz, with the eyebrow warrior.
Matt Gaetz does not have my vote. I in my campaign to become more like Nick Gillespie, which is a decades-long project at this point for me, I did attempt to spend some of this week looking on the bright side. I guess Matt Gaetz kind of likes drugs, so I too like drugs and would like
and
Matt
alternative Gaetz sexualities.
To I also like those. Yeah. So we have those two things in common. The rest looks pretty bad, guys. He seems like he is going to be both incompetent and evil in equal measure. Now, this is pretty standard for people who run the Department of Justice. I can't really think of a DOJ pick that I've been like, great, doing a great job for America in a long time. So maybe I am a naysayer. And maybe I just think we should abolish the Department of Justice. No one's listening to me about this. That's fine.
Wow, you're just actively against justice.
I hate justice, Matt. That's
we don't
what
have
I'm
a
saying.
Department of it. We won't have it.
If we don't, if the government doesn't have an official department of it, we won't have it. That's a well-known thing. Yeah. So I share America's trepidation about the reign of Gaetz, and I also would pick him to be the one to be most likely to go down in a confirmation hearing. Feeling kind of good about the existence of Senate confirmation hearings right now, which I also don't like. Don't like being there. Don't like to be that guy.
Nick, is there an argument that a kind of rough-mannered outsider is precisely what we need to uproot the deep state trappings of a department that has a lot of power and has done bad things?
The attorney general, and are we only talking about attorney general right now?
Yeah, we'll switch to bear hunter.
The attorney general is the holder of the presidential colostomy bag. They are always rotten, horrible people, and I don't think we should care that much about who they are because their purview is actually extremely limited, and we know what they do. They are the president's muscle on stuff like that. When you look at who is this in the past, people like Janet Reno, John Ashcroft, Mitchell Palmer of the Palmer Raids, Alberto Gonzalez, even somebody like Eric Holder. They were pieces of garbage who just do whatever the president wants them to do. And I don't mean to be a nihilist about it, but it's like
but
it doesn't matter. No, I'm just saying it doesn't matter that much because they get their comeuppance and they get held in check by other parts of government. But, whether Matt Gaetz is, will he be the worst attorney general of all time? I don't know. He's got a couple of good things besides his forehead going for him. And I don't really care. This one doesn't bother me that much.
Peter, you're from Florida. I was told that the Florida-derived chief of staff, Susie Wiles, was not going to have the clown car situation between Mar-a-Lago and the White House. So what happened?
Well, I think Donald Trump happened. And this is the thing that you see from all of these cabinet picks when you take them in context, is Trump is not a libertarian. He's
really?
Not a neocon. He's not
How
a conventional conservative. He is some sort of like Cronenbergian body horror monster of a Republican MAGA person, right? Like it's just, there's too many arms and some fingers where they shouldn't be. And you're like, it's kind of gross, but it's also like you can't really look away. And maybe it's terrifying. On the other hand, it's like, wow, there's something really sort of sympathetic about it. And you don't really even know at the the end, like if it's going to live through the end of the movie, right? This is a The Fly situation. Has nobody seen David Cronenberg's 1980s seminal film?
It's terrible. He's evocative.
Like, we are going to end up with a Cronenbergian body horror monster of an executive branch.
Say the third time.
And Cronenberg's Canadian, yeah. So it's a real threat to America.
Okay, let me try again. Let me try a completely different analogy. Matt, at the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned the Star Wars cantina.
No!
And it made me think of how Donald Trump's administration is shaping up, his cabinet is shaping up, to be a lot like the second of the Disney Star Wars mainline trilogy films, The Last Jedi. Because what happened in that movie was they gave the franchise for one film to a guy named Rian Johnson. And what Rian Johnson did with The Last Jedi was he busted the Star Wars myths. And he made a movie about how all the people who thought that Star Wars was sacred and beautiful and wonderful, the whole movie was like, actually, that's dumb. And Star Wars is kind of dumb. And we want to blow it up from the inside. And that was a really interesting idea. It was also kind of a terrible movie. And what we are going to end up with a Trump presidency, it looks like, is an administration that is designed to bust Washington's foundational myths about itself. And that's going to be kind of interesting. And we're going to see some things that we like from that. We're going to see DOGE, and we're going to see people say, well, look, we got to trim this down. We got to kill the regulatory state. We're going to hear a bunch of things that we like, but it's also going to be executed quite badly. And I would just point specifically to RFK, who over the weekend or a week or so ago was like, you know, I'm going to have some authority over the NIH. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to cut 600 positions. Great, great. Everybody thinks that's wonderful if you're a libertarian and a small government person. And then what he followed that sentence up with was, and I'd like to have 600 replacement staffers ready to go on day one on January 20th. This is not going to be an exercise in limiting government. This is going to be an exercise in reshaping government. I think Nick was right, along culture war lines and in many ways to sort of pursue a Trumpian new right JFK weirdo agenda.
Catherine, besides knowing that Peter is wrong about The Last Jedi, which was good except for the gambling island place or whatever that was.
That's like half the movie.
Just throttle him. Are there some good, plausible reforms to the Federal Health Service that you can imagine RFKJ doing?
Those are two separate questions. So obviously, yes, there are good plausible forms to the Federal Health Service.
That you could imagine.
Could you phrase that as a Star Wars plotline?
I shan't be doing that. Thanks for asking, Nick. I won't be doing that. No, I mean, Peter is right, and I will attempt to say what he said more briefly, which is to say that Donald Trump isn't an ideologue, and every ideologue in Washington right now wants to see their ideology in the new Trump administration if they possibly can. And we are not immune to that. And I was also at the American Enterprise Institute annual dinner last week. The neocons were like, he's one of us. You know, they were very excited. And this was like pre-Tulsi. You know what I mean? Like everyone has had like a little moment this week where they're like, are my guys in? My guys are not in. Our guys are not in because Donald Trump is not on a team ideologically.
Wait, so RFK is one of us?
No. The neocons were like the first couple of...
they liked Marco Rubio.
They liked Hegseth. Right. So that it was that moment of the week. I mean, so much has happened since we last podcasted, Matt. Everybody had their moment where they were like, is it good, actually? To answer your question, like, listen, we could like, I don't know, legalize raw milk or whatever. That would be great. We could theoretically, this is more obviously Department of Agriculture and other agencies, but like we could stop subsidizing corn, or that would be cool. There's a bunch of things that the federal government could do that would improve our food system, that would improve our health system. Is RFK Jr. going to like abolish the FDA accidentally while he's trying to get rid of seed oils? Like maybe, I don't know. But mostly what he is going to do is stuff like what Peter described, which is much more of a kind of highly agenda driven cronyism, which I do not share his agenda in many of those cases.
Nick. I'll just predict right now, he's not going to abolish the FDA accidentally or otherwise. Yeah, he might in fact make the FDA even worse.
He'll send it out for a walk and then lock the door and forget that it was out there.
Big Pharma definitely thinks that things are not going to go well for them under RFK. Now, you can read that however you want based on your biases, but...
Nick, let's talk about Big Pharma for a second, which is to say that...
Big Pharma.
The dominant pharma. I love how whenever you're on, one is on social media and you say something like, you know, RFK says some really crazy stuff about who killed Martha Moxley. They're like, you're in the pocket of Big Pharma. It's like, I wasn't really talking about that. I was in the pocket
also,
of...
Also,
like,
there's probably a golf club manufacturer who's somehow involved in the death of Martha Moxley. They're making money off it, Matt.
The putters. But one thing RFK said in the past week or two is that... that maybe what we need is that infectious diseases need to take an 8-year timeout, or the research of infectious diseases need a timeout. He's obviously a huge critic.
Be great if the diseases did.
Sure. I mean, maybe there's a possible armistice on the table that we didn't know about.
If only we had thought to put things we don't like in a timeout as if they were errant children.
What are the potential dangers, if there are any, of someone who is so dead set against a, you know, let's acknowledge, or let's say for the sake of argument, that it is a sort of corrupting institution in America. It's a corrupting, nevertheless, they do develop a lot of drugs, which are good. So what could happen if someone with his portfolio goes against Big Pharma in his perch?
I think, you know, to start with, recognize, and this is something where the RFK energy is coming from, you know, and by that I mean the people around him and people who were like, okay, I'm going to listen to this guy. We went through a pandemic where the CDC and the FDA and the groups covering infectious diseases didn't just fuck up a little bit. They fucked up massively in a way that if there was any justice in the world, they would be completely disbanded and then reformed. To the extent that we need these things. And it is good to have an FDA. It is good to have a CDC. It is good to have an NIH and things like this. So pretending, you know, there are major, major issues with the way the government covers, you know, various kinds of healthcare stuff. And this is apart from, you know, Medicare and Medicaid, things like that. And I think we should take seriously the energy around totally reforming these things or devolving them. What is good about RFK is when he says, I'm not going to take away anybody's vaccines. I'm not going to take away anybody's drugs. And, you know, can we streamline? Can we make the FDA better? On balance, yes, absolutely. And we should be, and we should have been doing this 20 years ago and 40 years ago and 60 years ago. So more credit on that. The fear that I have, and I think it was very neatly explicated by Ronald Bailey, our science correspondent, in a wonderful piece that's been at the top of the charts at Reason for most of the past week, or a good chunk of it, is that RFK is not going to say, okay, you know, we're going to let more things through. He is going to start calling for more and more safety trials on stuff which are already out and are already in use. He is going to probably retard the development and implementation of new kinds of treatments, new kinds of vaccines, almost certainly, but other kinds of drugs and treatments. And that is the problem. We don't want a government that is doing everything and telling people there is only one way to do things. But we also don't want somebody who is going to use the precautionary principle as a pretext for basically blocking all development and deployment of all kinds of new stuff.
A few points to end with is one, if for those who are as upset as Nick just expressed, and I definitely am, and all of us probably are, and many millions of Americans are, about the way that the federal government absolutely bungled COVID and the Biden administration in particular.
Trump is the one who shut the country down. He introduced the lockdown to
whatever don't let me finish the sentence.
Yeah.
All right. In particular, with its censorious regime that it came down with in 2021 and its various vaccine mandates and anti-scientific calls to mask 2-year-olds and such like that. So for the people who share that sentiment, you should be cheering appointment or the selection of Jay Bhattacharya to be the head of the National Institutes for Health from Stanford, who is a victim of that censoriousness. And that's great. That's a way to channel that energy more than someone who's kind of erratic. And I would also say that as part of the Biden administration's specific bungling of the COVID era, can you name the person who's the HHS secretary now? It's Javier Becerra. He's got zero qualifications for that job. He was the Attorney General of California. He sucks. He was appointed as patronage, and because they thought we needed a Latino there in order to make sure that there's not disproportionate harms to our Latino friends or something. I swear to God, that's what it is. Look through the recent archives for all the various ways that Becerra sucks, and like no one talks about it, no one cares. By no one, I mean the sort of traditional mainstream media, because that's just normal politics. But my God, RFK, that's just a bridge too far. That speaks to, I think, some of that exact same resentment that Nick was pointed to. All right, let's get to our listener email of the week. I mean, here in a moment, but first, a word from our sponsors over the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, even after the election, it's too easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion and cabinet picks. Understanding the real life impact of political events can be a challenge in these types of years. So we have got a podcast that we would like to recommend to you called Not Another Politics Podcast. It's brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. It provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today to Not Another Politics Podcast at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you acquire such things. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Tim Grimes, who writes, I'm so pissed at the Reason Roundtable. I'm just now able to put my thoughts together. Based on the last podcast, you are unanimous against Trump deporting illegal aliens. Why is it acceptable to you all to allow unrestricted border crossings with no penalty? Not only that, the tremendous cost to the taxpayers that are forced to support illegal alien social and medical services is unacceptable. We are a nation of laws, and they must be enforced. My Reason magazine subscription is due to renew. I think I need to think very hard about it, Catherine. It is a subscription threat, so you have right of first response. I'll just say that as described above there preliminarily, those are not unanimous views because I don't hold them. But go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for subscribing. I hope you resubscribe. We love subscribers. I love me some rule of law too. But here's the thing: we are not doing that in our immigration system now, and we wouldn't be doing that if we start whatever version of mass deportations Trump is going to do. So, a big thing that undermines rule of law is when we sporadically enforce laws, or when we create unenforceable, morally bankrupt laws. And that is the position that we are in with immigration. So if we arbitrarily start generating fear in communities all around the country about who is or isn't going to be deported after a long, long, long period, in some cases decades, in some cases long enough to found entire American-born families, and we just start kind of willy-nilly going around and deporting people, that is not going to give us a nation where rule of law is now respected and trust is restored. I also will say, just on the kind of note of the economics of the thing, if we are worried about the burden that illegal immigrants put on taxpayers, I would suggest that we let them work and pay taxes. That would really help balance the ledger very nicely. I think this is a concern that comes up a lot. I think it's a fair one. I would disagree about what the studies show generally about the net cost of immigration and even illegal immigration. But if we want to work on solving that problem, let them work. Let them pay taxes. I am happy this person has written in, and I disagree with his perspective.
Nick.
Something on the order of about 80% of illegal immigrants in America have been here for about 10 years or so. They are not disruptive to the country in the way that people are talking about it. So going in and rooting out people who have been here for a decade or more, who might have families, who might have become business owners as well as workers and things like that, not a good thing to do for the economy, if that's what we're talking about. As a rule, and nobody likes to admit this, I guess, on either side of the issue, it seems, but immigrants, particularly illegal immigrants, they use less government services than legal immigrants or native-born Americans, so they're not a stress on the overall system. We do need a secure border. And that needs to be put in place. And that keeps getting pushed back because people start talking about what are we going to do to get rid of the 11 million or 12 million illegals who are in the country here. We need to figure out how to fix the border and to allow more people to enter the country, you know, in a way that is transparent, visible, vetted, and legal. That's the main thing in front of us. People who commit crimes, people who commit violent crimes, or truly antisocial things should be arrested, and they should be deported. If they're immigrants, you know, and that's part of the condition of them being here, or if they're illegal. But the idea that we are going to fix anything meaningful by running massive workplace raids, and this is exactly what Donald Trump is talking about doing, and he has signaled with his picks of the people who will be doing this kind of stuff. He's talking about going back to family separations and a zero tolerance policy. He's talking about massive workplace raids that will remove, in his upper estimate, something like 3 million illegal immigrants a year until we're all done. That is going to cause many, many more problems than it has any possibility of fixing. So I think that's a bad idea. Fix the border first.
Peter, how do you answer the question?
Thank you for listening. Thank you for writing. And thank you for subscribing. So one thing I would say is that if you're concerned about the rule of the law, at least some of the deportations that have been threatened are themselves illegal, because the idea that, well, we're not going to do family separations, we're just going to deport whole families, in some cases means that we would be deporting American citizens. Beyond that, I would say, think about this as a sort of analogy to drug laws. So if you're a subscriber to Reason Magazine, I'm going to assume that you're at least a little bit skeptical of the drug war and the drug regime. And one thing that I think a lot of us would say is we don't want to see people who have who just have possession or just are using drugs and are not harming anyone. We don't want to see them go to jail. We think that that is an unjust law. And so we don't want to see that happen. Obviously, the main thing that we want is for the law to be changed to reflect the values that we hold, the ideas that we think are best. But we don't want to see people who are just using drugs and aren't hurting anyone. We don't want to see them in jail. And so it's not always, I think, you know, something that it's not always the libertarian position that, well, you look at this and even if it's a bad law, you have to enforce it. Sometimes the laws themselves you think are unjust and that shouldn't be in place at all. And so what you want is for enforcement to be prioritized. You know, one question you have to ask with deportations is just, is this the best use of government resources, which are inherently scarce? And then to go back to the point that Nick made, I would just emphasize further, in addition to this being at least potentially illegal if they're deporting, you know, whole families, including citizens, in addition to it being unjust in something like the way that we think that drug laws, drug restrictions are unjust, it's also potentially extremely economically disruptive if, say, the federal government is constantly raiding workplaces and deporting people who are here and who are working and who are contributing to the economy.
I would just add, besides being in broad agreement with my three colleagues about this in a kind of synthetic way, that 2 points. One is that the existing patchwork of laws is an incredible, confusing patchwork. We sporadically run charts in the magazine along the lines of get in line, now stay out, just showing what is the legal process if you want to do things correctly. It's very, very difficult. It's very Byzantine. And as a result of the way these laws are written, pressure gets applied in various little points there that suddenly overwhelm the system's ability to deal with it. For instance, asylum claims at the border, there's not enough processing of judges and things like that. So that's one. That's difficult. If fixing those laws would be help, more legal immigration will mean less illegal immigration. I know that's hard for people to grok sometimes, but I think it's incontrovertibly true that if you take this to extend Peter's analogy as a prohibition question, it starts to look different. And that's the language that Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush used when they were running for president in 1980 against one another. And then finally, about half of, and I haven't looked at the stats anytime soon, so maybe this has changed, but historically, around half of the people who are currently having illegal status, with their immigration, they're in America, and they are not legally doing X. And this is a category that quite possibly in the past has included Elon Musk and Arnold Schwarzenegger, among other people who I'm glad.
Melania Trump.
Melania Trump is possible, too. Are people who came here legally. It's just that the terms of their visa has either expired, they've overstayed, they worked when they were not supposed to work, technically, and that kind of oftentimes technicality. So that suggests two questions. One is there something that you can do with the extension of those visas for people that you definitely want to have stay and want to have work, per Catherine? But then the other one is, let's assume that these are, let's say it's a European tourist and they can come here for 90 days without a visa, but then afterwards, like, come on, Frenchman, get going. What is your mechanism to do that? Actually, I'm asking you, dear subscriber, that, like, how do you find that person, discover them, detain them, and send them out? What is that process? And will that process, by definition, harm totally legal citizen residents, Americans here? And that's something worth considering, because usually, in fact, I think always, the answer is yes, there's going to be collateral damage among Americans. The E-Verify system, which is a main way of detecting people who work here illegally, has famously caught up a lot of people because their social security numbers don't match up with their names. Maybe it's their maiden name and they've been married ever since or something. So there are costs associated with that. So you have to come up with a system that is not necessarily tattooing someone on their calf or putting a tracking number inside their skin. And I'm not making that up. That's sometimes been Republican presidential candidate suggestions. You have to come up with something that's not just people crossing the desert with a coyote. It is your friendly neighborhood European whose visa has expired. And how are you going to do that is a big question. All right. That's too long of an answer. Sorry about that. We started this podcast off with a nod towards the semi-normal sounding Trump slate of cabinet picks, but who are nonetheless quite a bit more interventionist than a lot of libertarians would want. So let's talk about that quickly, if we can. We got Mike Walls, National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, Elise Stefanik, at UN Ambassador, Pete Hegseth at Department of Defense, Kristi Noem, Homeland Security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What broadly, Catherine, do we make of this foreign policy team? Does it change the way that we think about Donald Trump? What does this make us expect about what's going forward?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, I was looking at this list of names again this morning and I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. And I think that is part and parcel with what we were saying earlier. He's not an ideologue. He did not come into office and say, I'm going to do neoconservatism. He did not come into office and say, I'm anti-war, as much as many, many libertarians would have liked him to be. And this list of picks reflects that. It's all over the place. And all that really we know is whatever Donald Trump wants to do, Donald Trump's going to do. And these people are probably, by and large, going to let him.
Nick, what do you make of this slate of characters?
I think we know what Donald Trump's foreign policy is going to be, which is going to be how he kind of did things the first time around. It is not as starkly non-interventionist as some of us might hope, but it's also not mega interventionist or neoliberal or neocon or whatever. I don't think the players matter that much in this. They didn't that much in the first administration, and they won't this time around. And Marco Rubio has the, he looks very much like the person that Trump will humiliate the most. He'll be playing the John Bolton role in this kind of administration, I think. But to the larger question of what his foreign policy will be, I actually, and this is a place where I'm cautiously optimistic. He's told Netanyahu to wrap
things up. Until next week.
Yeah, until this afternoon, probably. He's told Netanyahu to wrap things up. He's going to push for a negotiated settlement in Ukraine. He's going to scare people like, the leaders of China and North Korea and Iran and things like that. You know, from a foreign policy perspective, he's not coherent, but he is pretty effective. And, we should look towards that rather than the meaningless pawns in his game.
Peter, you have been someone who's pointed out that the anti-interventionists haven't produced a whole lot of kind of think tankery in Washington, D.C. There's been some that have sprung up over the years. When you look at this list, do you see any evidence, any counter evidence to your theory? Are there anybody here who's been working in the in these kind of intervention skeptical worlds that you see on this list?
Well, I think some people in the world like Tulsi Gabbard. That's not necessarily an endorsement of Tulsi Gabbard here, but I would just go back to the Cronenbergian monster metaphor here, because there's like, yeah, I'm sorry. There's just like, there's toes where they
it's
shouldn't
like
be.
Stuck to
and
your like, shoe.
It's, like... And there's just goop everywhere, right? And you're like, what is this thing? And
hold Catherine, that, push that Catherine's back like, in your stomach cavity, Peter.
Right. This is, the leader of the revolution in Total Recall, you know, when it's like a Quatu, right? It's like the guy in the belly. It's like, no, it's hard to say what this thing is, because what this thing is Donald Trump doing coalition management. And that means that he's got to combine in his cabinet elements of the kind of MAGA new right types as well. As I don't know, tech libertarian types like Vivek and you know, Elon Musk, as well as the remnants of the old Reagan coalition. And it doesn't make sense as an ideology. You can't sort of make this add up in a kind of, well, this is a coherent worldview. It's not. And that's what we see here, is this is not a coherent worldview, and that's going to make it very difficult to figure out exactly how it's going to proceed in the world. The one thing that I would say is what we see from Trump so far is that he is not the dovish anti-Ukraine interventionist, I think, that that some folks who were supporting him hoped he would be. He is much more of a Jacksonian, a hit him hard and get out kind of guy.
I would just add to all of this that tariffs and immigration are also elements of foreign policy. He has nominated border hawks. Tom Homan, who's formerly of ICE, is the border czar. We have a real one this time. Apparently, Stephen Miller is going to be White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, noted immigration restrictionist. Kristi Noem, DHS, I think, is we'll just kind of do Trump's bidding. And right now, there's a big fight over who's going to be Treasury Secretary. That is a kind of a big question, because that's the person who's going to be sort of implementing Trump's "we do tariffs now while we get rid of taxes" idea. Which I think is naive on the get rid of taxes idea, and not great for foreign policy and the raising of tariffs, which are, what's the phrase, Catherine?
Bad.
See, I thought you could quote the shirt.
Oh,
go
against
not
their
only
political
fail their
aims,
primary
but
objectives, dysfunction. But also do, yeah.
Yeah, bad.
All right, sorry. We
should be able to do this like as a chorus.
A
little song.
I feel like
back.
I got cold called in class. I was like, oh no.
To
trouble.
Call back to the discussion of DOGE, Department of Homeland Security, our latest, newest cabinet-level compendium of bullshit, that's something that could go without anybody missing it.
And
there's like nobody is like, oh yeah, the DHS has really helped us with a goddamn fucking thing. So,
amen, Nick Gillespie. Although, like many other things, that would take an act of Congress to do. You can say that I want to end X department, including the Department of Education. If you haven't legislated it, it ain't going to happen. Or at least they're going to still spend that money that's been appropriated from the Education Act of 1966 or whatever the hell it is. Okay, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, I understand that you would like to take a little bit of extra time, like a Sudermanian amount of time, to discuss your pick. Why don't you start?
I promise not to use the word Cronenbergian in this
Thank you.
Section. Okay. So I have been, for the last 8 weeks or so, in a book club. It's my third book club, because book clubs are great. And we have been reading Aldous Huxley's Island. And I want to make a little pitch for Island and then also tell you a little bit about the book club. So Huxley wrote Island. It's his utopia. He wrote it and published it a year before his death in 1962. And it's the flip side of Brave New World, right? Like, we all were force-fed Brave New World at some point. Maybe it hit, maybe it didn't. But this book is his portrait of the world that could be. It is a kind of mishmash of stuff that now feels very almost obvious, like it's a cultural cluster that simply did not exist before Huxley. So this is a kind of like, you know, there's some kind of Eastern philosophy in there. There's some utilitarianism. There's some Georgism. There's a bunch of psychedelics. And the book is structured around the idea that a cynical journalist washes up on the shores of this island and then walks around and explores it. It's generally not considered a super readable book, apparently. I found it to be fine, but to be fair, I identified with the main character, a cynical journalist who washes up on the shores of a utopia, and also I like Ayn Rand. This book has some Randian energy in the sense that, like, sometimes people just stand there and explain to you what the best society would be like. And if you have stomach for that, as I suspect that many of our listeners might, I would really suggest this book to you. If you want to read it, but you feel like you might need some people to read it with, the guy who ran my book club, David Alder, is doing another one that is, it's like available to the public and you can sign up for it. And his site is called The Psychedelic Society. It's Here and Now Studios. I'll put a link in the show notes. And he made us a little discount code because you got to pay money for this book club. So you can use the Reason discount code. And I think it's good enough to pay money for. I did. So if you have some interest in psychedelics, if you have some interest in utopias, if you have some patience for monologuing NPCs who explain to you what their society is like, you should read Aldous Huxley's Island.
I think.
Wait, they're monologues?
Catherine's getting a percentage of the cut.
What's the next book, Catherine? Has it been for the book club? Has it been named?
It's Island again. Like David Alder is obsessed with this book. It's a little unhealthy, to be quite honest. But he's just trying to bring this book to the world. So it's Island every time.
Is RFK going to reorient the NIH to, like, deal with the unhealthy obsession with this book?
Maybe. There are no seed oils in Island, I don't think. No, there's Nick, a lot of... There's
fictional
a lot of,
seed oils on the island?
There's a lot of cool stuff, including, like, you get guest speakers that are, like, people who have established their own weird little utopias to tell you how it's going.
It's just like the book version of Second Life.
Nick, no. I would like you to talk instead.
Have you ever read Walden 2, Catherine?
B.F.
Skinner's
not.
Utopian book, which started a bunch of clubs that tried to bring it to life, kind of like Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy. But it might be interesting to look at Skinner and Huxley in juxtaposition.
Sure. I'll add that to my my next reading list.
Nick, what did you consume?
I went to a play that is at New York City's Theater Lab through the end of the month called Loneliness Was a Pandemic. It was written by Olivia Holler and directed by Alex Kopnik. It's a small one-set play that takes place in a kind of indeterminate future where robots have effectively wiped out almost all humans but are trying to learn from artists, from painters, musicians, writers, and the like. And it's a great, intense kind of meditation on what the pandemic was like and how we kind of got super mediated in all of our interactions with people, as well as raising questions about AI and the, how do you define what is actual creativity or genuine thought versus just merely a very good fake version of it. It's an intense an intense way of thinking about the moment that we just came out of and one that we might be entering. It is not anti-AI. It is, I suspect it's anti-pandemic, but I highly recommend it. It's called Loneliness Was a Pandemic. I don't know where it will go after New York City, but I'll have links to material about it. But it's the beginning of art that deals with both, you know, COVID, but also the technology that we're working through in ways that are, really genuinely interesting and personal and idiosyncratic. So, and it was a great scene to go to a small play in a, an office building in New York where you go by various types of weird businesses and things like that. So Loneliness Was a Pandemic.
Cool. Peter, what did you consume?
I have been reading the science fiction novel, The Mercy of Gods. It's the first novel in a new series from the writers of the Expanse books. James S.A. Corey is the pen name of the two authors of these books. And I think if you've read the Expanse books, you will appreciate this because it is very much a big, ambitious space opera that is ultimately about being an individual in an authoritarian society. So it's in some ways a retelling of the Book of Daniel, in which sort of somebody from a little agrarian community is whisked off into a massive spacefaring authoritarian alien society. And it's about his attempts to adjust in and figure out how to learn in how to learn to be and how to learn to survive in this sort of group mind, hive mind situation where they don't care about individual identity and they try to suppress that. So this is the first book in the Captives War series. We don't know how many books there are going to be, but I think if you liked The Expanse, if you liked the previous 9 novels by James S.A. Corey, you will enjoy The Mercy of Gods.
Awesome. Apparently never-ending quest to find a damn decent documentary or documentary series about the Revolutionary War, hint, 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 everyone. I was documentary surfing on both Netflix and Amazon, and on Netflix I came across at great length Quentin Tarantino talking about spaghetti westerns. I'm like, all right, okay, well, let's just watch this one. And it was a piece that's an Italian kind of mini documentary, 79 minutes long, called Django and Django. And it's basically about the second best director named Sergio of spaghetti westerns, Sergio Corbucci, who I'd never heard of because why would I know that? And if you are interested in Quentin Tarantino talking about movies, regardless of how personally repellent you might find him, and that's kind of where my take on him is, it's great. It's very interesting. It's not a super well thought out documentary. It's mostly just a Tarantino interview with a lot of footage, but they also get Franco Nero in there and other characters from Italian cinema, and you learn stuff. So Sergio Corbucci, he directed Django in the 60s. He had a piece that I'm sure that Nick has seen that I was not aware of, but it looks awesome, called Navajo Joe, with Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds with the worst like Indian hair you've ever seen in your life, just like stone.
Got browned up a little bit too.
Got a little bronzed, and you know, he's the first, definitely the first Native American on cinema who his fighting style, which they go into at some he's just a linebacker. He's just clotheslining people right and left. It's very good for Longest Yard fans. But anyways, it's Tarantino talking about a pretty interesting kind of pulp, super violent, surprise, surprise, Italian director that you didn't know much about. Django and Django, check it out. It's on Netflix. I enjoyed it. I learned things I didn't know. It also made me want to actually go watch Sergio Leone movies because they're really great. And it's been a while since I saw Clint Eastwood eat a brown cigarette. So it's time to get back on the horse. All right. That's all the horse riding we have time for on this podcast. We do a lot of other podcasts and things. You can find them at reason.com/podcasts. We have lots of events too, especially in this event heavy season in the next month in New York City and Washington, D.C. Nick, why don't you start us with events that you would like to talk about? And then maybe Catherine, you have an event in Washington, D.C. that you would like to talk about. Go.
I am going to defer to Catherine, but for New York events, go to reason.com/events or go to reason.com/newsletters and sign up for the NYC newsletter, and you'll get a warning of everything we're doing so you don't accidentally stumble across a Reason event in New York City.
Catherine, what do you got?
On Wednesday of this week, we have the world premiere of a documentary about how things are going for tipped wage workers in D.C. I don't know if you know this. The government is not great. So we're going to have some of the relevant workers in the office. We're going to have snacks. We're going to watch a movie. It's going to be fun. You can also find this on our events page. It is this Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Come on by.
Awesome. If you like what we do, please consider giving a tax-deductible donation at reason.org/donate. That's kind of foreshadowing for what's going to be pretty soon, the season for the Webathon. It's going to be really exciting. We've got some special tricks for you that we'll be rolling out and telling you about kind of soon. Until now, hang in there. Do a cat poster, motivational something or other. Come on, man. Go do the thing. All right. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
I have a post-pod correction to make. On a previous episode, I said that the SR-71 Transformer in the Transformers movies was voiced by Leonard Nimoy. He was not. Leonard Nimoy voiced a different Transformer. Sorry.
Thank God.
Regret the error.
Thank God we have set the record straight.